Hello, and welcome to Top of the Ops, a podcast brought to you by The Drawdown. My name is John Whittaker, and I am the editor of The Drawdown, and I'm joined once more by the dynamic duo of operations journalism, Sylvia Saccardi.
Hi, John. Lovely to join you.
It's good that you're here, Sylvia, and also Matthias Klotz.
Howdy.
So yesterday was the monthly catch-up for the drawdown at our London HQ. Sylvia was the only one who stayed beyond one drink, I think, out of all of us. So what's the gossip, Sylvia? You look pretty spry from it.
I'm afraid I only stayed for two drinks, not one. So I think I've earned my name being Sensible Sylvia.
Well done. Sensible. We were all sensible. But we are not here to talk about our drinking habits, obviously. Instead, we are gathered here today to talk about Sylvia's cover story for the February issue of The Drawdown, which looked into semi-liquid fund structures. Now, Sylvia, can you first explain exactly what we mean by some semi-liquid funds, as there's some lack of consistency in market terminology? And then, can you tell us why these structures are of particular interest now?
Sure. In the context of this article, we're talking about a blend of closed and open-ended structures. The open-ended part of the vehicle allows for partial exposure to cash via regular subscriptions and redemptions, and this means investors are able to redeem on a regular basis at the net asset value of the fund. The evergreen structure of these vehicles means the fund has no fixed end date, with investors coming in and out of the fund at different times. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I got it, I think. We know that larger funds have been using evergreen structures for decades. And more widely, there's a debate about whether it's useful to blend open and closed-ended products at all. And some people argue that they're separate for a reason, right?
Exactly, and that's really the reason why we're talking about it now. Recently, we saw the EU's launch of LTIF 2.0, and I kind of compared it with the UK's LTAF. Both products supposedly offer more liquidity to investors via redemptions, but with everything, there's a catch, and I was concerned about possible over-reliance on redemptions, particularly when the regulation behind LTIF 2.0 probably impedes the launch of evergreen vehicles as it stands. But that's just me saying that. But we explored that in detail in the article.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, all very interesting. And I guess we'll just have to track whether GPs are able to launch evergreen structures with ELTIF 2.0 and whether the European Commission will amend the regulatory standards to better accommodate redemption mechanisms.
I think it's an interesting point because when the European Commission unveiled its retail strategy last year, the main points they were sort of highlighted in industry feedback, both from associations and from asset managers, was around the education of retail investors and the minimum investment threshold, not so much about the practicalities involved around actually setting up and operating these fund vehicles.
Yes, and we have to watch that space as it continues throughout 2024. But for now, well, I caught up with Luke Murwenda, who's head of private wealth at Eurazeo, who talks more generally about the complications of setting up evergreen structures. So let's have a listen to what he's got to say. Hi, Luke. How are you doing today?
I'm well, and you?
I'm good, thanks. We caught up recently for a discussion as part of the Drawdown's February cover feature, which offered a critique of semi-liquid fund structures. In our discussion in particular, we focused on the limitations surrounding the ELTIF 2.0 regime, particularly to what extent the vehicle can provide additional liquidity as an open-ended vehicle. That aside, the regulatory technical standards are yet to be approved by the European Commission, at least at the time of recording. So these issues may soon be resolved. We explored all that in the article, but I wanted to move the discussion on today to talk more broadly about the operational considerations needed when setting up an evergreen fund, whatever vehicle is used. So from your perspective, Luke, what would you say are the main benefits for a GP that sets up an evergreen fund?
Setting up an evergreen structure has a lot of advantage. The main one being that whenever an investor would like to join those kind of structure, it's fully funded from day one. That has a lot of implication. When you have a fund which is fully funded from day one, the money is at work at 100%. You don't have to, you're not at all, either if it's a professional fund, then you of course you make a commitment and then you will have capital calls over a period of 2 to 3 years. And if you are in a closed-end funds which is dedicated to private investors, I mean individual person, then the person will be called certainly, you know, again 100% fully funded, but the fund will take some time to deploy the equity, I mean the money raised, and that means that you have a you may have a very interesting performance in the fund, but you always have a lag because the cash is not at work 100%. It means that you can have a succession if you are long-term investors and you have a long-term program, and you will do a succession of closed-end funds versus a steady investment for the same period of time in an evergreen fund. At the end of the day, the evergreen fund will have an advantage because the money will be constantly at work. And that, I think, is a very compelling argument, both for institutional investors, but also for private individuals, because when, especially if they come to a fund which is already well installed with a substantial portfolio, and that means the fund is in the rhythm of its performance objective, the investor can be for 2, 3 years, 4 years, and he is expected to get exactly the performance objective which has been declared or intent, which is not the case on a closed-end funds. You see, and I think this is the biggest advantage. Money is at work all the time.
Yes, thank you. So it's clear that there is this main advantage of money always being at work. And you also mentioned that evergreen structures can be marketed towards traditional LPs as well as the retail investor.
Yes.
With setting up an open-ended fund, or at least when a traditional illiquid fund has a liquid portion, this brings added operational considerations and challenges. So how should you go about setting up an evergreen fund with these challenges in mind?
Yeah, the most important I don't want to be negative toward closed-end funds. Closed-end funds can be very interesting if you want to have a very pure strategy for a very specific agenda in terms of timing. But the purpose of an evergreen fund is a bit different. You would like to, an evergreen fund by definition will address a much larger investor base. This base of investor can be quite significant, especially if you're considering to propose those funds to mass affluent or to clients of private banks. You may very easily target more than tens of thousands of clients. This is the case for one of our fund. And it means that you have to take in consideration a few things. First of all, you must provide the most predictability possible into the strategies. Meaning if you want to address a large public of investors, you don't want to make too many bets. You don't want to take too many chances on risky strategies. You want to be the most very diversified. You want to be with a lot of predictability. And most important as well, if you address and if you're successful in doing that, you want to choose investment universe in which you can deploy a lot of money that you raised quickly, meaning that if you're on a strategy where there's not so many deals, where it takes time to make transactions, then you have an issue because you are going to raise some money, and if this money is not put at work, then you will not be able to show performance to your clients. And if you don't show performance, you're not successful in fundraising. Because the biggest advantage, in my opinion, to Evergreen Fund is once the fund is launched, it's like a mutual fund in a way. The potential investors is going to look at the track record of the fund and say, okay, the fund is doing some performance, it's doing well. If the fund shows that it's not invested, that it's not making any performance, the potential investor will say, okay, I'll wait. Why should I come in now? Because my money will not put at work. So clearly, you need predictability, and you need a large investment universe in which you can deploy a lot of money. So it goes, in my opinion, it will mean that the fund ideally should be a bundle of a few different investment strategies. In our case, we are interested in private debt all over European continental Europe. We looked also at secondaries in equities, and the advantage of those strategies is that you have a very large pool of companies all over Europe looking for private debt, doing secondaries, which is a very fast growing market. You also have a lot of opportunities to put money at work with predictability and a large diversification. So in my opinion, this is a key ingredient to make those funds a success. You know, I will not do an evergreen fund, for example, targeted on pure venture capital, for example. I think it will not be easy to start and to make it sustainable.
Definitely. So diversification is key for a successful evergreen strategy. One thing that does spring to mind to me in particular is navigating fluctuations in the economy and what effect that has on investor sentiment when it comes to redemptions. So how do you suggest GPs navigate the complexities and fluctuations of the economy when they might be offering a liquid portion of traditionally illiquid funds?
So again, what I just said about predictability and diversification are absolutely key. You want to be the most solid, the strongest possible into building your portfolio of companies, because you know you are going to be confronted to difficulties. I mean, if we take the last 6 years, we had the last 5 years, we had the COVID, we had the interest rate going up last year. In 22, there was the tech crisis crash on the stock market. So all those were, show volatility on the market, show that we're not always in the best situation in the economy. And this is why it's very important to be well diversified. That's one thing. What I find is important, you need to be able to offer some redemption to the clients. Not too much, because again, and that's important to be taken into consideration, those products have to be invested with to. They have to. I'm sorry. Those products must be proposed to clients as a diversification of their portfolio allocation. Meaning that, clients who are again the pool of clients we're looking at are from private banks are. Mostly mass well-off people, high net worth individual. Those people, they have money and they can easily allocate 10 to 15% of their portfolio to private markets, meaning that they have to know that when they go into private markets, they cannot have the full same liquidity as they will have on the public market. But, and this being aside, having, you know, quarterly redemption windows, I think it's perfectly acceptable for those people, because since they only allocate, you know, a portion of their assets into sort of private markets, it's very acceptable to have those a semi liquidity and not a full liquidity. And it means that when we when there is some fluctuation on the economy, if people need to redempt a redemption, they can do it, but the redemption has to be also capped to a certain level in the fund, because if you don't do it, if you don't cap the redemption with gates, you know, you probably saw that the market practice today all across Europe, the world is on Evergreen Fund is about 5% of the NAV every quarter. You could put your, if it will exceed, because at the assets are not liquid, you may have to sell too fast and to the detriment of the performance. So
yes, and we saw that in the real estate world, exactly, historically. So we wouldn't want to repeat.
So you have to accept also that you may not be able to have the full liquidity you expect in the case of a downturn. But again, this is done to protect the asset and to protect the best interest of the investors. This is why it's so crucial for investors to really understand that when they go into those market, into those private market, they can only go as a diversification of the assets allocation, and because they must have other source of liquidity if need be. You see, this is really absolutely essential.
Yes. So what I'm hearing is the liquid portion of the fund should not be overemphasized to investors. And perhaps the name semi-liquid in itself is a misnomer, because there is a portion of liquidity, but it should not be entirely relied upon. Perhaps that's why evergreen is a more suitable term.
Yes. But you see, Sylvia, this is, if it's semi-liquid, semi-liquid is not liquid. You understand?
Exactly.
So, and I insist, semi-liquid is important. You can have liquidity, but it's not all the time, and it's not necessarily to the full and to the full amount of what you need. But at the end of the day, again, if your strategies are well chosen, if your diversification is sufficient, then your fund will of course will be impacted by downturn in the economy, but you will not risk, you know, a total collapse of the fund. And and also the fact that you start to build history, of course, never been fun when it starts as no history, but when you reach after year number five, after year number 10, you have a history of redemption, and when you see that the maximum redemption you may have on your history of redemption windows is about 1% of the NAV of the fund, that brings a lot of confidence in the fact that clients know what they do, they understand what they buy, and then there is no accident. And this is very important. I will never emphasize enough the need for diversification and the need for stability and predictability in when you build an evergreen fund. I think this is absolutely key.
Yes. So I think there is definitely an education piece there, because especially if you are marketing to, let's say, retail investors or individual investors, high net worth individuals, i.e. anyone that isn't a traditional institutional investor, you need to be explicitly clear on the liquidity you're able to provide.
Yes.
And how is that education piece done? How do you communicate that effectively to this new type of investor?
Well, I would say at Euro Zero, it's about over 50% of the time spent by the wealth team is education of of financial advisors, private bankers, and all the finance professionals who are advising and clients. This is very important to provide a lot of support of education. So we do videos, we do conference, we organize masterclass, we go visit the bankers, we accompany them into conference with end clients. So this is a big part of the job, which again is absolutely essential. People need to understand that underlying companies the funds invest are in private market, meaning they're not liquid. The liquidity we're able to manage is built because we try to have strategy with short investment cycles, with diversification in vintage years, diversification number of companies. So all the time you have a multiplicity of small liquidity events which are able to generate cash in the fund, and this cash in the fund can be used to for the redemption. But again, this is, I insist on the semi-liquid and the education part. But actually, you know, I've been in this business for 20 years. It works quite well. People are smart. People understand that if they go to private markets, they're not in the stock market. They're not on liquid funds, and really, it's very encouraging because we have never, even in periods where we had some issues with the economy, people remain in the fund. And also it goes through a lot. You need to provide a lot of information and a lot of the key is the trust the investors have in the GPs, in the strategy of the fund, in the solidity of the portfolio. So also you have to be very much proactive. So you have to do education at the moment your client invests, but also then you have to be very proactive and transparent in providing information on the portfolio and the return of the fund and through your reportings.
Definitely. So absolutely, I would say that providing that education and that clear communication to your investors is really important, and therefore you would probably need additional resource within your firm to do that as a full-time job. So a last question for you before we end. How do you see the market developing to cater to increasing LP liquidity demands?
Well, I think that on top of the, I mean, you see the funds are proposing, are offering semi-liquidity through quarterly redemption windows. I think those quarterly redemption windows can be increase to monthly windows or even be weekly windows, as long as you stay into the bulk park of the 5% cumulative demand per quarter. So that can be easily done, and all those redemptions are done at the NAV of the share in the fund. So, but it's limited, of course, to this 5% of liquidity of the NAV of the fund every quarter. Then you can maybe go a step further, and we see that coming through technology, basically, with secondary platforms I would not say it would be an eBay of private markets, but you can definitely, and we start to see some initiative popping there, here and there. We ourselves working on such a solution, in which you will have a platform in which a seller who would like to sell his shares on top of those redemption would like maybe to put them on this platform, so someone can be interested to buy them. And of course, then the price will fluctuate. Of course, it will be like a market, unregulated, of course. So it brings a lot of, so you need for that to have a very good technology, but the technology knows, I think the tools are getting ready. Then the whole issue is the compliance, of course. to make sure that it's being done the proper way. So it should, for example, if a search platform should probably be third party platform in which the GP doesn't make any money on the transaction, because you have to be the more transparent, the more honest, and the most compliance with all the regulation, because you don't want to advantage some clients with more or less information. The trick and the most difficulty will be to fix the level of information that can be given to those potential buyers, because again, those are private companies which are not on the stock market. So you have issues of confidentiality in this company. You cannot say everything to everybody. So you have to be, and this is where I think the most difficult part will be, through the compliance and the local and the respective regulation, to be able to provide sufficient information to be honest and transparent on companies, but not go too much on confidentiality, because those companies, if they're private, they have a good reason to be private. They don't want to be on the stock market because they don't want to disclose everything. So that's a main issue. Lot of our compliance departments discussing with the regulatory authorities. This is ongoing, and I'm confident that we'll have some solutions, some first solution in probably in a year or two, maybe earlier. And you will see this all over Europe.
So you anticipate certain technological developments around the
secondary platform in which you can buy or sell shares on Evergreen Fund, but also on closing funds, basically. So our idea will be to bring some liquidity through a buy and shares through a small secondary market for dedicated to private funds.
Perhaps that's where LPs and other investors can access that liquidity that they really desire, rather than in fund structures such as the LTIF as it currently stands, but we don't know yet because it's
accepting in this case that we are not anymore transacting on the NAV of the fund, but on the market which demand. It means that the price of the share could fluctuate, you know, like it's on the stock market.
Exactly. So you're emulating the stock market without being on the stock market.
Yes,
and with that brings added complexity.
Yes.
Great stuff. Yeah. So I look forward to seeing how that pans out in 2024.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah, that adding a portion of liquidity into a traditionally illiquid asset class is complex minefield. And I think the key here is not to overpromise the liquid portion of the fund. We'll have to leave the discussion there, Luke, but thank you so much for your time. It was really interesting to hear your thoughts about successfully implementing an evergreen structure.
Great to hear the views from Luke there. There has been, it's fair to say, some market optimism about the potential for these fund structures to unlock access to retail investment. But it appears to me, and I guess you, Sylvia, that there are good grounds for skepticism here.
Absolutely. I mean, open and closed ended funds sort of behave like two ends of a magnet. That's how I like to think of them. Mm-hmm. But semi-liquid products have been heralded by some as a viable way to bridge the gap between private markets and retail investors. We've seen historically, when you overpromise liquidity in a typically liquid strategy, what happens? Just, you need to remember the break, for example. BlackRock has been capping redemptions for more than a year, which is not necessarily bad, but it's an example that you can't withdraw as much as you would necessarily like. So if you're a traditional LP, you might be aware of this, but I struggle to see how semi-liquid or evergreen products truly bridge the gap between the retail investor and private markets, particularly when these investor types behave very differently.
So I've had a couple of conversations with sort of our mid-market GPs, and a lot of them have told me that the high net worth individuals and ultra high net worth individuals in their investor base, they ask a lot more around questions around the amount of debt that firms use in their strategies. and they're particularly nosy about it, which I'm curious to see how that is going to play out in the long term, especially if more of those investors enter the investor base of the industry. Given that we are talking about an industry that traditionally relies on LBOs to finance acquisitions and now relies more and more on fund finance to kind of bridge the liquidity gaps.
Yeah, I think it's all about how much this hype is actually realized, right? And I think perhaps slightly provocatively, I suggested in the editorial letters for the latest mag that retail investors and private markets might not actually be the match made in heaven that some like to profess that they are. And some readers responded that the definition of retail investors is actually pretty broad and that there will be different products to suit certain investors. And I take that point. You know, it will no doubt be easier to explain limits on redemptions to ultra high net worth individuals than your mom and pop investors, for example. But a lot of education is still going to be essential if these structures are going to become more than just a niche concern, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been a lot of talk around the professional investor definition with responses to the European Commission actually including proposals for semi-professional investors or a professional investor upon accreditation. And there are similar concepts in EU member states, like in Germany or in Italy, for example. But also some concerns if, from a regular point of view, you broaden this investor base, it would imply a lot of regulatory changes to kind of the MiFID regime, meaning a lot of changes to an industry framework that is already very heavily regulated. Luckily, I don't have to do any of that. I just have to report on it, but it will be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I think the whole issue around defining what is an individual investor is super interesting. But I kind of think that we tend to move straight to that when we talk about evergreen structures, when from what I've experienced, I think this type of structure is also appealing to institutional investors because of the fact that it's a way of getting guaranteed returns, even though it's capped and at a smaller rate. What we really could be asking ourselves, I think, is should PE firms be thinking about introducing liquid portions of assets to satisfy investor demand, whoever they are, when the added operational risk and considerations are so high?
Yeah, and I think this conversation is far from over. But sadly, this episode of Top of the Ops is drawing to a close. But before we go, Matthias, can you give us a bit of a preview about what we're going to be discussing in the next episode?
Of course I can. So the next episode of Top of the Ops is going to look at fund finance, which was once a happy place where borrowers and lenders could do business. But now we have two main disruptions to that marketplace, one of them being Basel 3.1 and the other one being the liquidity crunch that the industry has been in there. And what we have as a result is credit rating agencies entering this space. I'm currently working on a very long cover feature discussing that in detail, and the next episode of this podcast is also going to touch upon it.
Look out for that podcast and the accompanying article coming soon on the drawdown. That just leaves me to say thank you so much to both Sylvia and Matthias for joining me today.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for having us.
As always. Okay, and thank you to everyone for listening. We will all see you next time.